Thank you to the presenters. Before we open up to audience questions, I have a few questions I'd like to ask myself. And so first question I'd like to begin with, and this goes to everyone on the panel. We're coming up on the first 100 days of the Trump administration, and perhaps the signature thing that's happened to Donald Trump so far is one of the things he said he was going to do first was pass an overhaul of the healthcare system, and that has not happened. His Treasury Secretary has talked about pushing back tax reform, I guess partially related to this. So do you have any sense now, you know, with about 3 months on the clock for his administration, do you have any better sense of what kind of president he's going to be for the economy in terms of will he be effective at creating policy? Do you have any sense of what his actual governing ideology will be now that he actually has, you know, the power of the presidency? So I'll offer it up to each member of the panel to take a crack at it.
Maybe I'll go first because I probably have the least to say on this. But we have a few months to answer that. We would say a couple of things. First, from our point of view, with the focus on the business cycle and the economic cycle, very often, especially in the near term, the administration is along for the ride as opposed to driving too much of it. And therefore, it's hard to attribute a lot. I mean, I think there was some confidence in market moves, but that's not really the underlying economy itself. And then I would turn to what we always look at, which is the leading indicators. And what have they done? And I showed for the U.S. The long leading index, which ticked down for what it's worth, and the future inflation gauge, which has plateaued. So the indications there may be one of a little moderation, I guess, on the margin, but that's about as much as we could read into it.
Yeah, I guess I just echo the remark that generally I think most macroeconomists caution people not to ascribe too much power of the president to affect the business cycle. Obviously, though, if the president does bad, I think it's easier for the president to do bad things to the business cycle than to do good things. So, and I mentioned trade as one of those. And I think that's particularly true when you're at a point of full employment, right? So 2, 3, 4 years ago, or maybe 4, 5, 6 years ago, I think most macroeconomists were saying probably a little more fiscal stimulus would work. I think right now you probably want to have a pretty neutral fiscal posture. And, you know, because you're at full employment, we think the Fed should probably do the fine-tuning at this point in the business cycle. So far we don't think the president, again, echoing the earlier remark, is having that huge an impact on first quarter or second quarter growth, and probably not even on second half growth. And we're just crossing our fingers that, you know, some of the more out of mainstream policies that were advocated in the campaign are avoided.
I think that fiscal policy would work right now, but I don't think it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I think that Trump is kind of trapped in the contradictory statements that he has made before the elections and after the elections, so it's really hard to see how the promises would go through Congress. And I think he's beginning to realize that these changes are not so easily to be implemented. I mean, he recently admitted that I could not imagine that healthcare reform would be so complicated, or that the tax reform would be so complicated. And I think it's the same thing when it comes to trade policy. He has a very simplistic view of trade agreements, that I will just, you know, increase a little bit the tariff and everything will magically be better. But this is not going to happen.
Do you get any sense that the protectionist trade rhetoric that he used on the campaign was just that, just rhetoric, and that actually as he governs, that, you know, we already see the border wall fading off into the distance, and that was literally one of his most important things he campaigned on. Do you have less worry now that he's actually going to be a truly protectionist president with all the risks that could come to the economy from pursuing that sort of agenda?
Yeah, I think generally, yes. Obviously, the things that can be done just by executive order are up for grabs, and you've seen more activity there, which may relate a bit more to regulations as opposed to newer, grander policies, including fiscal and budget items that are going to, as was just discussed, are going to run into the realities of Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, hard to know at this point, but I think what we've heard makes us a little less worried than we were in January. you know, I think some of the appointments, some of the Reagan-era trade negotiators suggest, you know, it's going to be a tougher line taken on trade, but it's not going to be sort of some of the across-the-board tariffs that were contemplated.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the meeting with the Chinese premier showed that the tone has changed a lot in the last few weeks.
I was taken by your chart about that 2,000-year history of economic activity and where dominance, where the, actually historical dominance has been in China and India. And, you know, we talk a lot about demographic challenges for the U.S. economy and for Western Europe. And as I understand it, that's also an issue for China as well, too, as a result of its, you know, the one-child policy. And generally speaking, you know, if we're in a world where interest, you know, the Fed's not likely to raise rates as much as it, you know, historically did, if R-star, the natural rate of interest is lower than it was, do you think there's an underappreciation or people aren't paying enough attention to these long-term demographic challenges faced in, you know, some of the world's most, you know, important economies, you know, as a long-run issue? You know, as people talk about policies that could, you know, lead to high levels of growth, all sorts of different things, are these demographic challenges being underestimated?
Less so. I think the answer was very clearly yes several years ago. And we've talked about that at previous conferences. But I think nowadays there's a lot more appreciation for the demographics and the productivity growth challenges. If you, I don't know the exact comparison, but take a look at India. India is... got a lot of potential for productivity growth and some pretty good demographics. And the market seems to be voting that way, even though there were some pretty radical things done with policy, for example, not too long ago with some of the, yeah, the demonetization and all these things. And still, the secular outlook there and in some other markets look quite a bit more attractive. And the comment I made about Germany's demographics speak to that to a degree. I mean, it's a big geopolitical minefield about what's going on with immigration. But the reality is, you know, growth is... how much is your labor force growing, and how much more can you, each person who's working, put out per hour? And you can't get away from that. So when we look at the policy prescriptions, you know, at the end of the day, how do they trickle down to those items? Are they going to help or hurt those items? So an infrastructure proposal is potentially very interesting. But it needs to have some sort of line going to productivity growth per hour, output per hour. Otherwise, you may be building a bridge to nowhere. And that's been tried too. And that has a short-term effect, but not a long-term effect. When you're talking about global trade, I mean, if you think about it just for a second, it's still one of my favorite statistics, even though it's getting old, is China's reaction to the financial crisis and with all the building that they did. In, I think it's like 11 to 13, they poured more concrete than the U.S. did in the 20th century. So they built a lot of things, But just what exactly is that doing for productivity or capacity or, you know, the potential for us to invest in other areas of the world? It has an impact, an unintended consequence.
Any other thoughts?
Well, I think that it's interesting to think if this slowdown in productivity is an exogenous or not. So implicitly, Robert Gordon or this approach to productivity slowdown is that we have an exogenous decrease in productivity that kind of limits the growth potential of the economy. But there are also other explanations. I mean, the slowdown in productivity in the United States has taken place in the last 10, 15 years. So it's probably a cyclical, and it's probably related to slower growth in demand. Okay. Another explanation of the slowdown in productivity could also be the slowdown in real wages. I mean, traditionally, the firms trying to increase productivity to save labor. Since labor is so cheap, then they don't really have the incentive to innovate as much as they had in the past. Hmm. So I'm not sure to what extent, you know, Robert Gordon is right that, you know, we have this exogenous sudden drop in productivity after 150 years of growth in the United States.
Yeah, I don't know, but
I mean, if we were looking at the data in the let's say mid-30s, we would observe a similar slowdown in productivity.
I think Gordon has shown that in every decade since the 40s, you've had declining productivity, with the one exception of the 90s, and then he just returned to the trend in 2000s and 2000 and through 17. Well, so I think the key there was that 90s, because that was the one little blip you had out. What do we know about that, and is that going to persist? And I think we know a good deal about the 90s just from a lot of cross-sectional evidence on both from firms and industries on the intensity with which they used IT, that seems to be a pretty important factor.
Right. So, capital investment in particular, I mean, you were drilling down a little bit into it. I had a statistic, because we've talked about this last year. So capital intensity, which is the ratio of capital to hours worked, it's a key component of productivity growth, has been negative since, I think, 2010. So that's unusual. That doesn't happen.
Right.
It's cheaper to hire a person if you have some demand, and there's hesitation maybe to invest a lot, and perhaps the IT is a piece of this. I'm sure it is, but there's a hesitancy when there's so much capacity. The capacity isn't heavily constrained at the moment, given the fairly low demand.
Right, so that's exactly the point,
that
it's probably low demand that causes this slowdown in productivity and in capacity building and increase in the output capital ratio and the low wage rates than...
Which comes first? It's kind of, we're getting a bit of a circle. Yeah.
Well, let's open it up to audience questions. Would you like to go?
Given that there's a consensus among you that the Trump effect is a nominal effect and not a real effect, that he's not going to implement the policies he said, and he was elected as the hero of a declining middle class, what are your projections for American society 4 years from now? He will fail. Do we have a radical third party along European lines putting up a candidate?
I mean, I'm just an economist, not a political expert. I would say that there is a cyclical element to income inequality. There's obviously a huge and much huger secular element, but there is a cyclical element. And I think at full employment, you tend to see more of the wage growth in the lower and middle income distribution. So I think there is some prospect, to the extent we can stay at full employment and not overheat but not slip back, that you could see a little bit of compression in wages. Not that that's going to get you back to the 60s or the 50s type levels, but I think there is some scope for some short-run improvement. How that plays out politically is not my expertise.
I think it was Michael Frohley's slide that talked about the declining rate of investment in IT. And I find this so startling because it seems like we're on the cusp of some sort of threshold of innovation in information technology with cloud computing and big data and automated cars and sensors and everything, you know, like smart manufacturing. I find it so hard to believe that this isn't at some point going to affect productivity growth, or is it some problem in the measure that it doesn't show up already?
Right. So I guess this kind of goes back to Yogi Berra's forecasting is difficult, especially about the future. And, I think it's particularly difficult about future innovation. So there is a lot of talk, as you say, about some pretty exciting things with autonomous vehicles and so forth. So far, that hasn't showed up in the data. Now, there is a question about the data quality. In my reading of the evidence, it has been, are we mismeasuring GDP? Definitely. The question is, has that mismeasurement gotten worse recently? I think there's less evidence. So we're definitely undercounting certain things, both in the overall economy, in hard-to-measure services, in IT. But I haven't seen much evidence that mismeasurement has gotten worse over the past 5 or 10 years in a way that can explain the unique features of the last 5 or 10 years. Now, that's not to say that some of the things you're talking about will pan out in a way that are going to spur greater capital investment in some of those technologies. Thus far, it's been more anticipation or speculation or hope than actual outcomes.
This gentleman right here, please.
Thank you. Paolo Savona. I agree with Nikiforos that one of the crucial points for the future is the Standard and Poor behavior, which is at present, according to the traditional formulas, consistent with the level of interest rates, also expected 2%, plus 1.5 of risks. So it is important not only for the U.S. economy, but also for the world stability. The rest of the world is looking to the behavior of Standard & Poor. So you had a negative judgment on this point because you said that perhaps the price earning is not consistent and will become more consistent if the fiscal policy of the Trump administration is in favor of increasing the denominator. I mean the yield of the shares.
Yeah, the valuation of the market right now is based on some expecting earnings, which like a huge increase in the earnings, which it doesn't seem that it's going to happen.
Exactly, the consistent with the 3.5% of yield. So this is the point. So you say not consistent.
Yeah.
What kind of formula are you using? Expectation. This is exactly what is happening in the world. People don't believe in the amount of finance in the world. This is the problem of Minsky. And so, but they are not looking to the reality. Mm-hmm. I don't know what kind of formula. What kind of formula are you using to judge that the price earning 30 times is inconsistent with the behavior of the economy?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
I mean,
also to the operators. So you are an analyst. What kind of formula they are using?
Well, the formulas I'm using are these conventional measures of the price to earning ratio.
The earnings from the budgets of the various operators of the market. They are not taking in consideration the expectation.
Right. Okay.
So now is
price earnings is equal near to 30 times. 30 times is consistent with the level of interest rates plus 1.5 expected interest rate announced by the Federal Reserve plus 1.5 of risk. So my judgment is that is consistent. Can go up also for a few points. But if the market don't use the correct formula and change the behavior because of this expectation not based on the behavior of the budgets of the companies, I think you are sending a message to the rest of the world, and they start selling shares, and so creating problems also for the United States. I don't know. Perhaps I am wrong.
No?
I have a certain experience.
Well, I'm certainly not forecasting the stock market, so I'm definitely not doing that. Not for the customers. It's richly valued, I think, is one of the points made. If things become normalized and nothing goes wrong and we just keep going, maybe it'll all work out. But there's a great deal of ifs. There's a few ifs in there and some hope. And we'll see. I think we're pointing out, certainly beyond the next couple of quarters, that there are some real issues. I think all of us have, in one way or another, said that today, which maybe we have a tiny bit of breathing room to start to address, and maybe we'll do it, and maybe we won't. I think we were saying, you and I were both saying, in a way, for just shorter term, for the next few quarters, the foreseeable future, things are looking a bit better, and it's been a long time since outside the U.S. hasn't been a bit of a drag, and so we have a moment here.
Mike, earlier we were talking about Stan Fisher's speech last night, where he mentioned how Hyun Sung Shin has been saying, you can't ask the market what it thinks. So to try and get what the market's saying, you can have hundreds of different narratives. And some of them may be related to anticipation of fiscal action. But I've heard certain operators who say, well, Q4, Q1 earnings are looking really good. They don't really care about the fiscal. So what is it? I think it's hard to say. If it's expectations of fiscal, or if it's deregulation, or if it's earnings, or if it's foreign growth, I think these all kind of point in a similar direction, but trying to disentangle it is really tough, which I think was part of his speech last night.
The gentleman in the green shirt, please.
Well, with the concept of, the three inequalities and so on, today we're about to get an executive order that says buy American, hire American. How is that going to fit into the longer-term thought process? Is that going to be kind of an immediate thing with impact into the longer-term projections that you have? Well, how are we going to look at that as a society?
I'll take it first because it's fair for the, let's say, the structural part, the middle part of the presentation, which was productivity, growth, and demographics. Any policy, buy America, hire America. The real question at the end of the day, beyond the other related issues with respect to structural growth, is does that shift in any way demographic growth, the labor force growth, or does that shift productivity growth, output per hour? And I'm not clear on how that would do that. And, when you're dealing with policy, which is a tricky thing, there's also all these unintended consequences that you might be on, at least on some level, okay, this seems pretty straightforward, but what are the unintended consequences? And you were talking about all, the supply chains and all of the way these things, the intermediate goods, and all these different things that are happening, that could get really mucked up very fast, yeah.
Yeah, just the only thing I'd add is there's some uncertainty as to how that would also fit in with certain bilateral and multilateral trade agreements that are already existing. I'm not a trade legal expert, but I know those concerns are out there, so I think that's just one more consideration.
I agree. Both.
The gentleman with the beard.
Yeah, for Michael Feroli, if we got the assumed collapse in the market, about a 30% correction in the market, for whatever reason, what would you say is the most likely impact on the economy in terms of wealth effect and whatever else? How much could it affect growth? And then, of more interest, what is sort of the maximum likely effect you can imagine that you or the consensus might say would happen as a result of that? In other words, yeah.
Okay.
I'm looking for sort of two different numbers.
Sure. Okay. So I think in terms of wealth effects, we used to think prior to the crisis, every dollar of added wealth would raise the level of consumption by about 3.5 cents. The experience since the crisis has been more like half that magnitude. And there's a bunch of reasons why that may be so. Some people talk about inequality. Some talk about reduced ability to access housing wealth through HELOCs and so forth. There are, like I said, a number of another one is just that people are treating wealth gains more cautiously given, you know, fool me, you know, twice, shame on me kind of attitude. So I think that could kind of bound. I think the estimates on the wealth effect is between 1.7 to 3.5% of the lost wealth in reducing the level of consumption. What that would do then for business investment, I think, one, you have just reduced demand. There is, as you know, there's a lot of economists in the audience, the Q theory of investment. I think my previous life, I was the CapEx guy at the Federal Reserve Board, so I have some experience with that. The Q model as an empirical forecasting model doesn't hold up as well as things like accelerator models. So I wouldn't think that necessarily would have a huge hit to CapEx beyond what it does to final demand. And lastly, I just point out, I think it's kind of difficult when you say this exogenous hit to wealth. I would kind of like to know what's happening there. But whatever is driving it, one can assume that the Fed is going to not be raising rates. They're going to be cutting rates back to zero and probably expanding the balance sheet once again. So that could have some offsetting effect in terms of both asset values as well as the impact on the economy.
So that sounds like maybe only a few tenths of an impact?
So I'd have to go, I would need a little more time to run the numbers.
Anybody else? Right there.
Hi, it's a question for Mr. Feroli. You didn't want to talk about that latest inflation number.
No, I did, but I didn't want to get into the details too much to bore the crowd.
Just maybe just some of the detail. Did you see anything in the details that would make you think this was either an aberration or that there's something in there that will make you believe that core PC will pick up again towards 2% by the end of this year?
Sure.
And if not, how does that look, June or July hike?
Yeah.
How does that make it look?
So I think the biggest aberration, one that everyone saw, was that prices for cell phone services declined 7%. Apparently, this is only for new contracts, so if your contract didn't go down, you weren't being mismeasured. This is how they do it. Even if you strip that out, because it's a pretty small component, core CPI increased only 0.04%, which would still be a huge miss relative to what consensus was looking for. So we should expect that to reverse next month. But even with that reversal, there were other parts that were still weak. So core goods was surprisingly weak. Generally, we think when the dollar is depreciating, import prices go up and goods prices go up. That hasn't happened in spite of 3 months of dollar weakness. And then probably what was, you know, there's a category there that basically measures rents, imputed rents for people who own their own homes. It's called owner's equivalent rent. That's been slowing a lot over the past 3 or 4 months and continued to do that last month. Why that matters is that doesn't jump around a lot. There's a lot of serial persistence. So if that's weakening, that had been kind of a bulwark lifting up overall core inflation. If that's going to be on a softer trend, it could slow down the path toward 2%. We generally think that, you know, with labor costs rising, there's gradual upward pressure. We certainly see that unit labor costs, which are adjusted for productivity, have been putting downward pressure on margins. Corporate profit margins are still high, but they've been coming down. They peaked about two or three years ago, so they've been coming down because of rising labor costs. The question I think a lot of people have is, how much does that get absorbed in lower profit margins, and how much gets passed on to higher prices? So far, the bulk of it has been squeezed profit margins, but at some point, firms are going to try and push that on. So we think the path to 2% still looks attainable by year end. And we think with an unemployment rate of 4.5%, the Fed is still inclined to go in June. As much as they talk about, you know, flatter Phillips curves and all that, I think at their heart of hearts, that is how they forecast inflation. So I think they probably feel like, all right, we get a little breathing room because of this. Still going to go in June, I believe. But it, perhaps at a less hurried, you know, tempo, or risk of a less hurried tempo than that.
Anyone else have a question? Back there.
Hi. There's a bit of an inconsistency in different stories that you hear reported, not in anything that anybody's been saying here, but an inconsistency in terms of demand for labor and supply of labor and productivity. On the one hand, you hear anecdotal stories about how hard it is to find tradespeople, craftspeople, plumbers, electricians, so forth. At the same time, you hear that the new jobs are all in high tech, that you need a lot of new high tech people, on the one hand. On the other hand, you see things like productivity down where it is, you know, down at the very low level. You see that it's now cheaper to hire people than it is to invest in capital products. It seems that one of the things that's missing in all this analysis is an overall analysis of the composition of the workforce. Who's measuring, are there any measures of the composition of the workforce? So for example, in the household survey of the BLS, it says that there are about 4 million people working in computer and math-related fields, 4 million out of 140, 150 million people in the whole workforce. If the demand for work is in that area where there's 4 million, how much demand is there that's going to bring up the overall production, that's going to bring back higher salaries, greater productivity? At the other end of the spectrum, where you do see growth, is you see growth in food services, hospitality, and food services particularly, and temporary workers. If you look at it over the overall composition of the workforce, you see these low-tech, low-wage, low-interest kinds of jobs are the places where you see the growth occurring in the actual statistics. So is there anybody that's looking at the composition of the labor force on those terms? Where are the jobs numerically really increasing? What has changed over the last 30, 40, 50 years in terms of the composition of the workforce? Has anybody looked at that? Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, well,
you can go ahead and then I'll.
I mean, there are several different ways you can slice and dice. As you mentioned, the household survey has occupation. And they also have by education level. And then as you turn to the establishment survey, you have it by production workers and non-supervisory workers versus supervisory and non-production workers. And then industry, which kind of gives you a little bit of a better sense. And then you, of course, have the usual median weekly earnings, which is a quarterly survey, has a little more detail there, and then you have the annual occupational survey. When we kind of go through all of these, we don't think the job growth in recent years has been all that low quality in terms of either the skill mix as measured by education, traditional supervisory versus non-supervisory. A variety of measures suggest that to us it doesn't look particularly low quality. It tends to be the case that usually in recoveries, at least in the early years, job growth, but not levels, is low quality because you tend to lay off those people first, right? So you're hiring them back. And so some of the job growth, at least in the first few years, did look lower skilled, or however you want to phrase it. And in terms of the wage growth, we don't think there's a huge mystery there. It's, you know, we only got to around 5% unemployment last year, and like there are some lags here in terms of tighter labor markets to wage growth. And those lags, we think, probably are a little longer in part because there's just less churn in the economy now. So fewer people quitting jobs, for the same amount of net hiring, there's less gross hiring and gross separations. And that may slow down the process a little bit because a lot of the aggregate wage gains come when people do job-to-job switches. And there's less job-to-job transition, so that may, we think, speculate, has led to tighter labor markets having a slower kind of transition into higher wages. But we think the quality has not been particularly bad lately in our reading.
We've got time for like one or two more questions. Has anyone like that?
One slide I didn't see up there was credit creation. Could you guys comment about where, like, actually the most recent, news was C&I loan growth from large banks has kind of started to roll over since January. And just where are we in the long-term kind of credit trend?
I'll make a quick comment on that loan growth in particular is a bit more, I mean, it's related probably to what happened with the decline in energy prices, but it's also traditionally a bit more of a lagging indicator, in particular C&I. So we did have a slowdown in the economy from 15 into the end of 16, in the middle of 16. So it's reasonably consistent with that. I think, you know, going forward, you want to watch what's going on with consumption.
I would totally echo that on the C&I. It does seem to lag. And it probably reflects that levels, we think, that levels of CapEx, even though they're picking up in Q1, are still low, whereas levels of internal funds have gotten a nice boost over the past two quarters because of better profit outcomes. So we think it's lagging, that probably we start to see C&I pick up again after, I don't know if it's a few months or a few quarters, but we would be more concerned if the data we were seeing was pointing to capital spending slowing. But as I said, the most recent data seems to show a bit of a pickup in Q1.
So final question. I thought I saw a hand back there.
It strikes me, this has been a wonderful panel, but it strikes me it could have been titled Four Decades of Voodoo Economics and the Consequences Thereof. Some of the things that jumped off the graphs for me were, I think it's true that this last recovery is unique in the decline in government spending, the decline in fixed investment, or at least the relatively slow growth of fixed investment. And we're the banality of the public discussion of policy with voodoo economics on one side and stronger together identity economics on the other side without any attempt to think about the connection between economic growth and the investment that fosters productivity is just continues to dismay me. And I guess I'm making that comment to ask, do you see anything turning around in the quality of the public discussion?
No. I mean, I'm sorry, but I wish I agree with you. But I don't... Actually, this kind of conference is, you know, somewhat unique in that sense. But unfortunately, I don't have anything to push back on what you said.
I wish I had a more optimistic final answer, but...
I think there is some improvement. I mean, nobody would talk about inequality 15 years ago. Now even the president of the Fed is talking about inequality. Fiscal expansion would be a taboo in Washington. Now it's probably slowly getting a more favorable year. So I think there is a slow improvement. I don't know if it's going to be fast enough in the future to fix things, but this remains to be seen.
Okay, well, I guess we're at time here. I want to thank the panelists who did a great job, and thanks for enduring me. And thanks.